welcome to the fourth episode of Tales for the East, a podcast series from Denniston, Sighthill and Haghill in Glasgow's East End. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Alistair Satchell and I'll be your host for this series. Today, I speak with Stuart Cosgrove of Denniston. Stuart is a writer, broadcaster, television executive and so much more. A resident of Denniston for many years now, Stuart originally comes from Lethem in Perth. Our conversation covers a huge amount of ground, from the nature and diversity of Denniston's community, how traffic issues are affecting the area at this moment in time, and then on to his youth in Perth, his studies in Hull, including the influence of Philip Larkin on his career, then on to Stuart's working life. We also talk about the importance of soul music. We touch on the life and skills of the late Mary Wilson of the Supremes, and then we round off with a reflection of Gaelic in the community. There's so much in this episode. There's also two naughty words which pop out later on in the episode, so please feel free to add your own beeping sound at your own discretion. As we recorded this conversation over Zoom, there are occasional odd noises and pinging sounds. I've tried to edit them out where possible, but you will hear the odd pop and growl, for which I do apologise. Enough havers for me, it is with great pleasure that I now hand you over to Stuart Cosgrove. Who are you?
I am Stuart Cosgrove. I was born and raised in a place called Lethem in Perth, which is kind of still nostalgically home to me. And I grew up there in a working class family in a council house in Scotland in the 60s and 70s. And I'm now a writer, a television producer, a radio presenter. And I've recently taken a kind of retirement from Channel 4, where I was an executive producer and commissioning editor at the channel. So I've kind of had a very varied but active media and arts life throughout probably the period when I first went to university in the 70s.
And how long have you lived in Denniston for?
I've lived in Denniston now for the best part of 25 years, maybe slightly more, 26 years. I first came to Denniston, and although I didn't actually live there initially, I came because of a Channel 4 project that we were doing for a Friday night transmission called Halfway to Paradise. It was a mixed kind of media with lots of music and stories and kind of perspectives and films about Scottish life, creative life particularly. And that was filmed in an old converted film and TV studio called Black Cat Studios, which is based in Springfield Road in Parkhead. And as it transpired, being one of the kind of series producers of that series, I was on location at the studio and elsewhere in Scotland throughout the period of maybe 2 or 3 years. And I decided that I was going to rent or buy a small flat in the area simply because it was more convenient than commuting from London, where I had a flat. Interestingly enough, being from Perth and not being able to drive, I also made the decision that I wanted one as close to the motorway as I could get. When my mates picked me up to go to St. Johnstone games, it was easy to get on and off the motorway. So the criteria was near Black Cat Studios in Springfield Road in Parkhead and near the motorway entrance point, which happens to be Denniston. And I went round the Denniston area and I bought initially a small flat in Armadale Street. And then as my life developed and I became wealthier, actually, and able to kind of stay in Scotland for longer periods of time, I bought a house off Craig Park. So I've lived in Denniston pretty much all my Glasgow life. I briefly had a little period when I was in a flat in the West End, but the logistics of Denniston worked for me. It's a short walk to George Square and to the Merchant City. It's kind of like got very good housing stock, really strong kind of, if you look at red and blonde sandstones, it had both of those, and it had places where you could kind of do up a flat but still get one at a relatively cheap price or inexpensive price. So I was motivated by all of those things. And I came to Denison and very quickly started to, if not fall in love with it, start to see it as a familiar place. And then gradually over time, it became the community I lived in, and I became interested in all the various different elements of the area, the politics of it, the culture of it, the way in which it was transforming socioeconomically. All of that stuff fascinated me. So I would say, first and foremost, when people joke now about me, they talk about me as if I'm from Denison, but I'm actually from Perth.
What were the factors that made you feel like, okay, I identify with what's going on in this community here and all the different progress and other things that are being made? What were the kind of key factors that made you go, there's something really interesting here?
Well, you know, that's a good question, because I think there are actually many and varied, but at the core of them is that really important thing about the definition of the word gentrification. Often the word gentrification is used quite negatively. It's usually an area that's kind of, you know, builders go in, they build trendy flats, they make their money, a kind of middle class moves in, and that becomes the sum total of this gentrification. I saw Denison differently to that. Although there's no question that lots and lots of people were moving in because of the relatively cheap housing stock, it was also the case as well that other kinds of things were going on. So at the bottom of my road, the council had allowed artists to open small startup gallery space. There was quite a lot of people that I knew that lived and worked in the area that were themselves artists. Lots of kind of, you know, WASP studio was near to where my house is. And when I first moved in, I jokingly say now that took two very kind of fine artists who were living in the street at the time. They've since moved, but it was Roddy Buchanan and Jackie Donaghy, who were living together, and they just had young boys. And Roddy and Jackie were, you know, phenomenally successful kind of artists from the conceptual and environmental arts tradition that, you know, Glasgow's world class in. And I got to know them because they were neighbours. I mean, they're three doors down. And I always remember at the height of the Glasgow artists successively winning the Turner Prize, I used to do this joke where I said it was humiliating walking down the street in the morning, since I was the only person that never won the Turner Prize, right? You know, and I had a kind of feeling that this was an artist community. But let's look back at Jackie and Roddy themselves as people. They were artists that have got a fundamental understanding of the artist's role within society and within the cultures and communities that they live within. And they are very, very kind of committed to that concept. And in many key respects, they were people who were against the idea of kind of economic gentrification. Just simply, they wanted the place that they lived in their case, Denison, they wanted it to still have a profound relationship to real experience and real people. And the interesting thing about the area as well, which doesn't often happen in London in the kind of world of gentrification, is that in London, often when areas gentrified, poorer socioeconomic people were moved out because they could no longer afford to live there. That's not been entirely the case in Denison, in part because there's social housing that still exists within the area, in part because people, older people, have lived there throughout their entire life. So, for example, my son Jack goes to St. Denis's Primary, which is in Denison. If I was to talk you through all of his classmates, at least half of them, at least 50% of them, have come from families that have been in Denison for over 50 years, you know. So there hasn't been, you know, their grandparents lived there, their mum and dad went there. And I think that Denison's been able to sustain the two great things about social change, that it's not kind of demonised and chased away the people who built that community over decades, but it's also brought in new people that have enriched the community and given it a kind of new feel, a new kind of status. And I think that's a really, really important thing. So, for example, just to give you one tiny, tiny example, there's a very wonderful florist shop on Duke Street called Foresters. And if you ever pass it, the women that run it, I think it's three sisters that run it, you know, they had been at Jack's school decades before. They're from a family, I think, of eight people, mother, father, and six kids, who lived on Duke Street and have done throughout their entire life. So you get the feeling that there are people that you're speaking to that are, have been wholly resident in Denniston and know it better than I'll ever know it, you know.
Within that, then, is there a tension between these two identities, the people who've come in and the people who are native there? Is this, I mean, native's a difficult term, but is there a tension there that leads to interesting creations and solutions?
You know what? I think that clearly there would be underlying tensions. They're not tensions that would ever manifest themselves in any kind of public or vitriolic way. I sometimes share a joke. Because I've been in Denniston long enough now, 26 years, I can fake that I'm native, right? I can almost kind of speak to both generations. And I sometimes like a bit of a laugh speaking to older working class people in the community and having a laugh at the cost of a coffee now on Duke Street. And, you know, but they understand that a lot of the new cafe bars that have opened up and baristas and that have opened up, they've noticed that they're clearly kind of, you know, more continental, more aspirational, more expensive, with food that wouldn't necessarily be available in traditional cafes in the 50s and 60s. But I think they also realise that they've been part of Duke Street. It's not a street that's completely dominated by bookies and charity shops. Although those things are there, they don't dominate the way they do in other parts of the East End, for example.
That's fantastic. Thank you. Yeah, that one other person I was speaking to was saying about the charity shop and tanning salon mixed with delis and galleries. And it's like, that's just a fascinating kind of, it's very sincere.
Yeah. I was going to say the other dimension that we've not mentioned is actually the student population, who of course are maybe more kind of fleeting, more peripatetic. But a lot of them have kind of also stayed in Denniston in postgraduate or when they get their first jobs or, you know, as they're building their businesses. And I think students are vital to the story of Denniston. If you look, obviously, westwards, you don't have to walk too far. Maybe, you know, half a mile and you're into the fringes of Strathclyde University's campus. Glasgow Cali's not far away. The art school is not far away. And so Denniston historically has always had this kind of cherished relationship with creative students. And I think that's a really important part of its kind of story now. And that's not to necessarily say that, you know, that the students who come stay there forever. And, you know, people come and they move on in their life and they fall in love and they have children and they have reasons to look for gardens or for bigger homes or any of these things. But the student population has always been an important part of the Denniston mix. And I think they bring an awful lot of value to the area, creatively and economically.
I wasn't aware of that kind of that dynamic change within the area. That's, yeah, because that'd be over generations that'll have had a massive influence on how things are, but also the area will have had an influence on them. So that kind of that nourishing thing, that's fantastic.
Yeah. Well, one thing that, you know, they're going through a period just now of trying to kind of tame the traffic problems in Denniston, and the traffic problems are pretty intense, and that's partly to do with the fact that, you know, you've got two main thoroughfares, Duke Street and Alexandra Parade, and all of these other kind of streets that connect them, and they're trying to find a way of kind of just taming the volume and the speed of traffic, and I think generally that's quite a good thing. But you know, let's look back. Let's look at a street like, for example, somewhere like Finlay Drive or Rosalie Drive or any of these streets in Denniston. Much of the building, both red and blonde sandstone, were from the high kind of Victorian era, 1870s, 80s, 1890s. And within these buildings of the old kind of, as it were, Denniston estate, you had six or eight homes within that. And this was six or eight homes before the car even existed. Now, every one of those homes has one or two cars parked out in the street. And it's just simply too much. I'm the chairman of the Parents' Council at St. Denis's at my kids' school. And one of the biggest challenges that the school faces is the whole problems around traffic in the morning as mums throw their kids out the door as they're driving to work. And it causes quite a lot of congestion in the area and a lot of kind of short-temperedness early in the morning. And I think that that whole idea is quite a challenge to Denniston. One thing you'll probably be slightly surprised by is that people who are commuting, let's say from Livingston into central Glasgow, often just simply park in Denniston and then either take a bus into town or in some cases walk or jog or some have a fold-up bike in the back of their car. And they're parking there because, quite rightly, they can park for free. And if they drive into the town centre, they have to pay a tenner or whatever. So people have been very clever about using Denniston as a kind of park and ride area, parking in the streets. And the building of the city park, the big business park on Alexandra Parade, suddenly brought about kind of 10,000 people working in there into the area. And many of them have cars. And they park them rightly because they're not looking to pay a fee. They park them in side streets, on the road, something's up on the pavement, and it can be quite chaotic. And there are just simply too many cars. But how do you deal with that when the car don't drive? So I can be pretty kind of brutal about this, but I know that my partner drives and she fetishizes her car. She can't actually go anywhere without being in the car. So it's not an easy problem to resolve. I was reading in a blog quite recently. In fact, it was something that was shared by Paul Sweeney, the former MP and Labour MP for Glasgow Provident. And Paul was fascinated by industrial history. And he pointed out something that I'd never, ever known before, that in areas like Denniston, where you have the red sandstone tenements next to the blonde sandstone tenements, he explained that the blonde sandstone was usually stone that had been cultivated from quarries in and around Glasgow. And then when the railway lines were built down to the south west of Scotland, particularly into the Dumfries areas, the red sandstone was mined from quarries in Dumfries. So Glasgow wouldn't have had red sandstone were it not for the pioneering railway lines that were set up to take stones from further away quarries. Now, I walk past those houses every day and you never really understand their full social history.
What did growing up in Perth give you, do you think, and in Lethem in particular?
Well, what it gave me is it gave me an understanding of what place was and what home was. My father, Jack, died when I was a very young boy. He died in a lorry crash in Perthshire. And having a tragedy early in your life is difficult enough. And then as a young boy who's trying to kind of come to terms with the world, losing your father so early is quite a kind of profound emotional moment. And it meant for me that I grew up in a household of women, two sisters and my mother. For various reasons, it was also the case, we're living in a council house in Lethem in the north side of the city, which is the biggest housing scheme in Perth. And my mother was only a part-time shop worker at the time. And so our income, the money that came in every week, was tiny, and she had a fairly kind of patronising widow's pension, which was minuscule. Lethem has always been in the top 10 of social deprivation in Scotland, and within that housing scheme, we'd have been in the lowest quartile of families in terms of their income. So I had a pretty deprived upbringing, but I always try to qualify that by saying that I had an economically deprived upbringing, but a spiritually very, very, very supportive, happy, and generous upbringing. You know, not only my mother herself, my two sisters, but the memory of our father, and he was a trade unionist, and what he represented, and the friends that he had built up that remained, including his younger brother, my uncle Billy. They were all, the spiritual support I had was immense. And I think that sometimes too often we speak about poverty as if it's a single issue, as if it's only to do with money, only to do with income. Now, there's no question, as Karl Marx suggested, the economic determinants, and of course, not having money is a huge determinant in your life. But I had an awful lot of kind of support in my life, you know, encouraged to do things, encouraged to do well, encouraged to read, all of those things that make you spiritually wealthier rather than economically wealthier. And so, you know, I think it's quite an important thing not to jump to conclusions about what poverty actually means, because it can mean things clearly in terms of deprivations. But you'll find often in some households, I think this is particularly true of places like Denniston, where Denniston had quite a lot of what you would call working class intellectuals. By that, I'm meaning people who were, you know, maybe plasterers or maybe working locally, working in factories, working in the shipyards, but they had maintained a passionate interest in a subject. Now, that subject might be the history of Celtic Football Club, yeah, but equally it might be socialism, or it might indeed be horse racing or whatever. But it created in the mind of that person a desire to learn. And often I know lots and lots of people in my life who grew up in relatively working class and in some respects deprived communities where they were encouraged to learn and where the whole idea of knowledge was really valued. And I find that to be at the core, really, of the kind of Denniston that I respect and that I've come to love. And that's to do with the fact that there's people who are one or two generations away from the working class but still believe that issues right, like social justice and things like that, really matter, you know.
Years ago, I was working in a project for the old arts company that was on the High Street in Glasgow. It was a French company that had come across. I'm a French speaker, and they were needing an interpreter and an artist to work with them, so I got the job. And we went to the Bloc Éireann, to the fruit market, because we were studying what happened between the transition between the old fruit market and the new fruit market, and we're trying to capture stories and stuff. And it was fantastic. I was there, you know, sort of 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock in the morning. And at the end of the shift, one of the old porters who'd been at the old fruit market into that just looked at me and went, "Do you know what Alexander the Great's horse's name was? It was Bucephalus." And I'm, "Oh, right." And it was that sense of like, yeah, don't ever think to minimise me. And it was like, yeah, you're damn right. I'm not going to minimise you at all.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. And I think that there was quite a lot of people, they used to say that if you went to the Mitchell Library in the public reading rooms, there would be world-class intellectuals in there, none of whom had ever left Glasgow. Do you know what I mean? They were just sitting in there studying and doing the crosswords and picking up on the history of socialism or the history of social history. Social history is something that really engages people when they start to understand it. I meet lots of people wandering the streets in Denniston, and they'll say to you things like, "Did you know what that building once was?" And they'll point up at something, and you'll go, "No, tell me." And they start to go into a really interesting story of maybe its kind of relationship back to the Denniston estate or slavery or even going back to the Edwardian and Victorian era. And so I think that local history is one of the real drivers that people feel that they can keep in touch with the world they live in, but also a wider world of history and sociology, you know.
You've got this fostering of knowledge, this fostering of investigation that's clearly part of that. Who were the people that fostered that knowledge in you? And then how did that lead on to your next steps into further education?
Well, first and foremost, there was my dead father. Although he died his memory, his presence never left the house, you know. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons for that is, as a trade unionist, he spent a bit of time in, he was quite senior in what was called the Carter's Union, the horse and motorman's union. And they were beginning to merge with what was then the Transport and General Workers Union. And gradually, he would be spending a lot of time going out on away to conferences, you know, and they were typically in Blackpool or Dunoon or, you know, Whitley Bay or wherever the conference was, Labour Party or Trade Union Congress. And then he was taken off on delegations to fact-finding missions to Eastern Europe, to East Germany, to Czechoslovakia, to Russia. And he would bring back all this kind of stuff that he would bring back for me. And one of the things that he brought back was this volume of books called In Quiet Flows the Don. And it's a great kind of epic sort of history of Russia in the period of kind of the White Russians all the way across. And it's quite a kind of big epic book in Russian literary history. And it stayed in the cabinet in his room throughout all of my life. And I don't know that anybody ever read it, but it was given this kind of totemic status, you know, that were books that my dad had got in Russia and that we should all, you know, read them, but they were actually written in Russian, so none of us could read them. But they had this kind of, almost like, they were like an altar to him in my mum's bedroom. And obviously my mother, who herself was very active then within the Labour Party, she was another kind of nurturer of knowledge. My uncle Billy, who kind of mentored me as my dad's younger brother, he would take me regularly to the football. He was the one that kind of taught me all the various different, the languages, the kind of the knowledge, the history of football. I vividly remember standing, we were at a St. Johnstone game and we were playing Partick Thistle in Perth, and we had sold a player called Dan McAlinden, and he'd gone from St. Johnstone to Thistle. And this was his first game coming back to play against St. Johnstone. And I remember my Uncle Billy, when he got the ball, he bent down to me. I can see his face now. He's passed away now. But he leant down to me and he said, "Oh, no, has Dan come back to haunt us?" And that's the first time I'd ever heard that metaphor or that expression. And so he taught me all of those things, if you like, the wider language, social language of football, and the idea that a player could come back to haunt you. There was something almost elegiac and actually literary about it as a statement on a football terracing. So he was a great kind of influence in me, on me. And then I started to get involved with a community theatre group. Now, I played at the community centre in Perth, which is where I first started to hear Motown and soul music and that. And they had all these kind of youth club nights. And one of them was run by an outreach from Perth Theatre. It was called, the group was called the Gangabouts. It was actually, in other words, to go about, it was a peripatetic theatre training school. And they took me into that. And I started to become one of the kind of stars of what became Perth Youth Theatre. And the woman who ran that was a woman called Kathy Robbins. She ended up being an artistic director at the Eden Court Theatre in Inverness. But for that period of time, she was a big influence in the sense that she was encouraging me to get involved in theatre and improvisation. And I got a job at Perth Theatre as a kind of just as an apprentice. So that helped me with another body of knowledge that was coming through at the time, great plays, adaptations, travelling, Scottish opera and travelling and things like that, giving me an insight into things I would never otherwise have known, you know. So that was important. And then Kathy turned up one night at my mum's house. She brought me home in her car. And my mum saw her through the kind of glazed window of the door and said, "What have you been up to?" She thought I was in trouble. She thought this was a teacher bringing me home. And I said, "Well, the Kathy wants to speak to you. So the woman came in and she said to my mum, look, Stuart's good. He's very good. He's one of the best kids we've ever had. You really need to encourage him to go to drama college. And my mother went away. She thought about it. She was really chuffed because clearly I was achieving something, you know. But she looked into it and she took advice from people around her and Lord knows who. And somebody said to her, oh, the trouble is, if he ever wants to apply for the civil service, he needs a degree. A diploma wouldn't be good enough. So this got into my mum's head. But if you ever, and I'm saying to her, but mum, I don't think I want a job at the civil service. Aye, but if you need one, son, and it became that. So basically what happened is my mum and I went, I don't know how we did this, went down to Perth Library at one point, this old Sandeman Library, and we started to look at where, because there was no internet, so we were trying to look at where drama was taught as a degree subject. Now, at that time, Glasgow University didn't have a full degree in drama. It was, I think it was only a kind of joint degree or maybe even just a diploma, I don't know. But the nearest, physically the nearest to me was Hull University in Yorkshire. That was the geographically the nearest place to Perth that did a degree in drama. And wow. So I put that as number one in my UCA form, and I ended up getting in to study drama at Hull University.
Wow.
So it, to some extent, that was part of the journey of me getting into film and television and that, because television was taught as a kind of theme within the course. But it was very much about theatre history, about performance, the performing arts, and film and television, you know. So that's where I started to kind of build up a love affair with the performing arts, and particularly with film and television.
Well, that then brings me to a question that I hadn't anticipated. So did you know Philip Larkin then? And did you know the Hull Truck Theatre Company?
Let me take you in reverse order. I'll start with Philip Larkin. Philip Larkin was the librarian of the Bryn Mawr Jones Library, which is the library within the university. It's actually called the Licorice Allsort Building because it's actually black and white stripes outside. So it looks like a big Licorice Allsort on props, right? And that takes you up. It's got six floors, and the stripes, the Licorice Allsort stripes are the six floors. And the top floor, because it's nearest to God, was where theology was based. And it was where Philip Larkin's offices were on the very top floor. Drama and literature, English literature, were on the fifth floor. But I used to go up to the sixth floor because it was easier to get a desk that you could sit at and read, or little armchair and things like that. So I would periodically see Philip Larkin disappearing down a stack of books, or, you know, he's very, very visibly, very easy to point out because of his kind of bald pate and everything. And of course, he was famous. By this time, he was probably England's most famous poet ever, or certainly modern poet, and certainly the most famous poet that's still alive. So, you knew Philip Larkin. But here's a really, really interesting connection here between myself and Philip Larkin, is that Philip Larkin was an absolute diehard jazz fan, a big, big jazz buff. Jazz pops up in quite a lot of his poems or whatever. And like all great librarians, he had a spending budget second to none to buy books. So Philip Larkin, in order to indulge his own passions, bought every single jazz, R&B, gospel, history of slavery, history of civil rights, anything to do with the jazz culture. And he bought them, and they were all on the sixth floor near his office. And I was probably his most enthusiastic reader. I would go up to those rakes of books and I'd pull something out and I'd go and sit and read about jazz or blues or the early days of soul, civil rights movement. And it was Philip Larkin. He didn't introduce me to soul. That happened back in Perth at the community centre. But he was the one that first exposed me to the literature of soul music, if you like. So I have great respect for Philip Larkin. And I always used to get slightly niffed about a piece of graffiti in the lift. There was a piece of graffiti in the lift. I'm sure it's been wiped out now. And it said, there's a sign of a waspish side of me, makes me laugh, but it was a terrible thing to say. Larkin, it said in the graffiti, call yourself a fucking poet, they don't even rhyme.
Oh, that's brilliant.
And of course, it was down to that kind of dumb idea about what a poem was, but it was there for him to see every day as he went up in the elevator to the sixth floor. So Philip Larkin, yes, he was there. Yes, I did see him. And yes, he gave me access to books on African-American music and culture that I wouldn't maybe otherwise have been able to afford or even find. Many of them were imported from the States. The Hull Truck Theatre Company were from my department. So they were 2 years above me, the originator.
Right.
Yeah. And Hull Truck were, they were the train, when I first got there, they were the trendy students. Interestingly enough, I had been asked at the school, the Perth Academy where I went, to go for an interview to get entry into Hull. And the secretary at the school, that for some reason, the university rang the school saying, how would I be for overnight? Because I was coming from Perth and it was a distance I wasn't going to be able to do in a day. They'd called the school and the secretary, without me really knowing this, said to the woman, look, you know, Stuart's from, you know, a family. He's not a single mother family. His father's died. There's not a lot of money in the house. He can't afford to stay in a hotel, a city centre hotel. It's not that kind of family. Could one of the students put him up? So the university had gone to the students and said, we've got a boy coming down from Scotland for interviews. Why don't you put him up in your student flat? So the first day I arrived there, I was staying at Hull Truck's flat, right, from day one. So I've kind of known them or known of them, obviously, over many, many, many years as they evolved into, you know, one of the great kind of alternative and fringe theatre companies that Britain's ever produced. And they were very, very fine. The core Hull Truck group were very good performers. But, and this is quite an important but, they had all studied theatre history from the age of kind of 18 through to 23, and some of them were still hanging about the university. Hull University has a really brilliant studio theatre called the Gulbenkian Theatre, and it was one of the best university theatres of its day. And so Hull Truck could effectively hire a night, say a Wednesday night, and put on a show there. So their first ever shows were done really within the university studio theatre. So I knew Hull Truck well, and they were very, you know, at the time they were really famous, and there was a certain kind of aura about them. They were like the pop stars the campus, you know, until Tracy Thorne arrived, and she truly was a pop star on the campus. Everything But the Girl came, I think, 3 or 4 years after Hull Truck. So both the members of the group were at Hull University. They'd known each other before then and came to university together. But Tracy was on the campus when she was on Top of the Pops, you know.
What was the bridging point from going from university into your professional working life? Where did your work take you, and how did you get there? If that's not too big a question.
The key big step that's kind of between those two things was that I ended up getting a very good degree at Hull, and I'd applied for what's called a major Scottish studentship, which was the then Scottish Education Department. So it was before there was a Scottish Parliament. So the Education Department had this major Scottish studentship that I was obviously able to apply to. Requirement was that you're normally resident in Scotland, you are a Scot, etc., etc. And I pitched this idea, and it's quite an enlightened thought now, actually, when I think back to it. But I pitched this idea that I was going to be studying in America. It was a postgraduate scholarship for people that were going on to do their PhD. And I was going to stay on at Hull and do my PhD. And the university were really good at backing me. And so all the references were really strong. What the university would provide, all of that stuff was in great form. And I had had this idea. You still get this if you search for it in the web, because it's up there promiscuously there. I had had this idea that I wanted to write about an event that happened in Los Angeles in the 40s called the Zoot Suit Riots. Mm. This was a series of kind of face-offs between mostly Hispanic and Chicano teenagers against local sailors and Pacific-based army bases and that. So it was about the whole idea about patriotism and the war. I'd read about it only kind of partially, but I put together this pitch document saying that I was going to study the Zoot Suit Riots as part of my PhD. And I applied and I won the studentship. Well, I think there were two things. Firstly, they were saying, well, the guy's at an English university, and we want to be periodically seen to be backing our students when we leave Scotland. So I think there was a little bit of that in it. And then there was, oh my God, this Zoot Suit thing sounds terribly hip. Let's be hip as well and support it, right? So both of those things came happily together for me. And I won a scholarship to go to America to university, where I was for on and off for the next 3 years, whilst I was also writing freelance for soul music magazines and things like that. So I spent a lot of time in Washington, D.C. particularly, which was the main city I was based in. I actually was registered for library purposes in a great library at Howard University, which is the urban university in Washington, D.C., one of the famous historically African-American universities. So it's probably the black, they call it the Black Harvard as their kind of cliche for it, but it's a great university in the center of Washington, D.C. It's probably, if you were to give it its modern cliche, it's Black Lives Matter University. That's its kind of, okay, you know, its kind of status. It's quite a lot of kind of radicals, political thinkers, musicians. It's got a great, great department of jazz studies and soul music and things like that. It's where I first heard of it. I read about it in a soul music magazine. And so when I went there, they gave me researcher's rights. So I was effectively allowed on campus with my ID to go to the library and research. And then I moved on to another university in North Virginia called George Mason University, where I studied further and then completed my PhD. By this time, I'd kind of written about the Zoot Suits, and I'd won what was called the Academy Award, the British Academy Award for academic essays. And my Zoot Suit won that. It was great at the time because I got £1,000, which I was still in my mind a kid, you know, and a grand was a hell of a lot of money at the time. Still is a lot of money. And so that gave me the kind of money to continue a little bit more in America than the scholarship money allowed, but the scholarship money was the basis of why I was able to do that, you know.
That's fantastic. And so how did you go from America to, was it London after that then?
By this time, I was getting a lot of attention at Black Echoes. Echoes is a weekly soul and reggae magazine, and I was eventually their top staff writer.
Fantastic.
And the NME, Newsday Express, had come under criticism from within their own editorial and indeed from their own readers that they were still sticking very closely to post-punk rock music and weren't reflecting dance music, the club scene, and what eventually led to the mix of kind of hip-hop and rave and all of those other club cultures. And so they kind of effectively transferred me. There was a transfer fee for me from the Echoes to the NME. It came in the form of adverts that Echoes were allowed to put in the NME. It was good for me. And I spent the next 4 years as an editor at NME. And I was black music writer, staff writer. and the media editor were the two jobs. And I stayed there for 3 or 4 years until I effectively joined Channel 4 soon after that.
Why then is music, and particularly soul music and music of Black origins, why is that so important? And why does that carry universally like it does? Why do we connect to it in such a profound way? And how did you first connect to it with, you know, Perth Youth Centre, wherever you were when you heard it? What made that first note resonate in your soul? Go, ah, aha.
You know what? There's a simple answer and maybe a more complex one. The simple answer is I think we're all kind of hardwired to love the music of our youth because it carries with it all sorts of other memories, the memories of growing up, the memories of having your first girlfriend, the memories of, you know, being able to stay out late, the memories of your first dabble into drink and drugs and all of that. So I think the music of your youth has a very special kind of place. It's hardwired into your mind. And for me, the music of my youth was Motown, it was soul music. It was Stax, a little bit of ska and reggae, but particularly the music of Black America just kind of resonated with me. Now, I was very fortunate because I would argue even to this day that the Motown sound, the dominant sound coming out of Detroit at that time, is amongst one of the greatest and most joyous pop music ever made. And so to some extent, I've never been. You know how you sometimes get people when they talk about the first music they listen to, they sort of talk about it in inverted commas as if they're cringing slightly because they grew up and realised what they were listening to was a bit shit. You know, I've never had that. The music I fell in love with is the greatest music ever, you know, and I was lucky. So that's the kind of simple answer. The more complex answer is that I was with my mother one day in the kitchen of our council house. And we had a little transistor radio. And it was on, and I could tell you it would be about the 24th of July, 1967 was the date. And I heard this man, he was a journalist, speaking live from the streets of Detroit when the Detroit riots had erupted that weekend, the last weekend in July. And this guy was excited. He was an American broadcaster, and he was saying, "The Motor City is burning. The Motor City is on fire. This is a crisis for America." And I can hear his voice now in my mind. And I remember saying to my mum, "Mum, this is big. This is the biggest thing ever." And I was kind of voicing to her the idea that my music had another meaning. It wasn't just about love and about going to the community centre and getting off with a girl and walking her home. It had this much bigger purpose, which was its kind of, if you like, its global and social politics. So although I wasn't necessarily enunciating that in the room in the kitchen with my mum, I was becoming aware of this being much bigger than just the music of falling in love, you know. And it's remained a lifetime passion. I mean, I will die loving soul music. I mean, I know that's one of the consistencies of my life. St. Johnstone and soul music, I will die loving the two of them. I can be sure about that. And, you know the way people, they come and they go, and other trends come and go, and jobs come and go, workmates come and go, but they'll never take away soul music or St. Johnstone.
I listened to an interview with Mary Wilson from Australian Broadcasting Corporation, their Conversations podcast, and it was Mary talking in her own lifetime about how she and the others got started in the Supremes. And one of the things they would do is they'd stand at the footwell of the big stairs and the big high-rises, and they'd use the echo to sing and get this perfect acoustic to practice. Do you think that transfers to the east end of Glasgow at all, particularly Sight Hill and areas like that? Have you seen this kind of organic expression of creativity that have you seen that manifest itself in your world?
Look, I don't think there's any doubt whatsoever. What Mary Wilson was describing there was an urban experience. And I think if you flash forward now to Sight Hill or to Black Hill or to Carentyne or wherever, you would find areas where now mostly kids wouldn't be singing gospel, they wouldn't be singing soul, they wouldn't be singing a doo-wop. They would be doing hip-hop and they would be doing, you know, beatbox with their, you know, mouth music and things like that. So I think there's no question that urban experience can find expression around the world in areas, including Glasgow. One thing that I do want to say, and it's one of the things I feel very, very passionate about, is that Mary Wilson, when she tells that story, that particular story, it has in many respects become one of those stories that gains kind of myth and builds up into, it's a great story, but it gives you a feeling of place. They were living in the Brewster Douglas housing projects in inner city Detroit. It was the first post-war housing project that had been built for African-American families after the war. So it had a kind of social significance in Detroit. But the Detroit schools at that time, including Northwestern High School, where Mary went to school, was not so far away from her housing scheme at the time. As a primary school student, she'd been bused. She was part of the early busing experience. And in actual fact, was bused with her school friend, Carolyn Franklin, who's Aretha Franklin's younger sister. And the two of them were bused out to Michigan, to the suburbs, to a school that had a lot of white kids, and they were trying to break down discrimination. By the time she went to high school, she was back locally at Northwestern, which was by then almost entirely a black school in inner city Detroit. But in order to maintain, if you like, fairness in the education system, Detroit schools had introduced a really, really, I think, very visionary policy of identifying the best singers, musicians, in the whole of the schooling system within Detroit, in the area known as Wayne County. And they were all given singing lessons by professional coaches, vocal coaches. And Mary Wilson's vocal coach was a wee guy. I've forgotten his name off the top of my head, Alistair, but he was a small kind of Jewish guy, white guy, bald guy with glasses, that used to have a bike, a cycle. And he would cycle to all the houses where he was coaching musicians. And Mary Wilson's name had come up as one of the community in Northwestern had put her forward as one of their top singers. And he would come to her house after school and teach her vocal phrasing and give her vocal coaching. I interviewed Mary on stage at the Victoria and Albert Museum in London. And I mentioned this story to her, and she warmly remembered the old guy. We laughed about it and chatted about it. And she said one of the things that he did was he taught me how to differentiate between opera and jazz and R&B and what was effectively pop soul music of the time. And he was and classical music. So this man was giving her different kinds of vocal phrasing. And I said, well, do you still remember what he taught you? And she said, yeah, of course, it stays with you all your life. And I said to her, can you do Stop in the Name of Love as if it's from an opera? And she got up from her seat, went to the microphone and did Stop in the Name of Love as if it was a classic opera aria. Then I said to her, what about jazz? And she scattered into the intro and then sang it as if it was like a kind of Nat King Cole jazz song. Then she did it as a kind of classic Supremes with a hand going up.
Yeah.
And you just thought, my God, what a brilliant talent, you know. But I like the idea that a school's education department, and it's Wayne County numerically almost is as big as Scotland. So we're talking about 4 or 5 million people that live in the county alone. And they send round vocal coaches to people's houses for the simple reason that they've shown an ability to sing in their school, you know. And Mary benefited from that. And I'm sure lots and lots of other kids of that generation benefited as well. But, you know, it's like art, it's like music. Unless you invest in talent, at that younger age, the way that I was helped by Travelling Theatre Company when I was a young boy, people miss, they fall through the gaps. Their creativity is lost. And when someone is not able to exercise, demonstrate, or celebrate their creativity, they become more bitter as people. They become people that feel as if they've got a talent that was never recognised. And I know lots and lots of people in my life, and I'm not talking necessarily about Denison, I'm talking about a university, I'm talking about in London, back home in Perth, who feel as if they could have done something if only they'd had more push, more encouragement, more creativity, and of course, more investment at an early age.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much. One very last question, which is a specific thing that's been sort of plugged into this project, which is it's called the Gur Project, and it's about Gaelic in urban environments and the nature of Gaelic in Glasgow. Are you aware of Gaelic in the community in Denniston and the area at all?
Well, I'm aware of it in a number of different ways. First and foremost, of course, is schooling. The Gaelic school is one of the most popular schools in the whole of Glasgow, indeed in the whole of Scotland. But it's popular amongst parents in Denniston. And so the Gaelic school bus leaves every morning to take kids over to the school. And I'm aware of it in that respect, that the community is served by it. But let me tell you another little kind of story here, which kind of makes me feel kind of warm, and sorry for kind of going back into football here, but I was interviewing the former St Mirren, St Johnson, Motherwell and Morton striker John Sutton. John's the brother of Chris Sutton, the famous Celtic and player. He comes from a footballing family. And, of course, he moved as part of his career to Scotland, played football up here for 10 seasons or more. And as often as the case, he fell in love. He lives over in more in the Paisley area in Bishopton, or one of those areas in Renfrewshire rather than in Denniston. But when I was speaking to him, he was sitting at home one day and his wife had sent the two kids to the Gaelic school. So here's a man up from Norwich, plays football, and suddenly he's got two kids in his house who are studying at the Gaelic school. And of course, one of the requirements is that the parents start to learn the language as well to help their kids out. So he said, I'm speaking basic Gaelic in a very, very bad Norwich accent, he said. And it was very funny. And he said, and I'm sitting at home one night and my wife gets a letter from the school, a newsletter from the Gaelic school, saying that they were hoping to restart up a school's football team, but they were lacking someone that had kind of coaching skills and whatever. And she turned to John and said, you've got the coaching badge from the Scottish Football Association. You could coach the school team. So he got roped into coaching the Gaelic school football team, primary team. And I was laughing at that because, you know, a lot of people can look at Gaelic and say, well, you know, it's not well enough known, not enough people speak it. It's a nationalist shibboleth that people want to prop up for political reasons. You hear endless arguments against Gaelic, but you know what's really, really good about it? Is it gradually, in very kind of subtle ways, infuses and insinuates its way into people's lives, and you realise that what you're dealing with isn't a dead language or even a language that's on life support. You're talking about something that's revitalising itself in the community. And I'm currently working on a book just now, which is about the story of American soul music in as much as it interacts with the various presidents of the United States. So it's called Hey America, Black Music and the White House. And the chapter I'm currently working on is a chapter that follows Barack Obama against the backdrop of the mass shootings in a church in the Carolinas. It's called the AIM Church Massacre. And what's really brilliant about it is a young mixed race, black parents and Celtic father has a kind of Celtic tradition. Mm. And the young singer who's made the song that best kind of crystallizes that moment is the singer Rhiannon Giddens. And Rhiannon Giddens is actually a Gaelic speaker who's a black woman who sings soul music out of the Carolinas. And I couldn't resist that. If I can't get a good 1,000 words out of that, I should be taken out to the streets of Denniston and shot, right?
Thank you so much, Stuart. It was a delight to get to speak with you. While you'll certainly be familiar with Stuart's Radio Scotland programme, Off the Ball, which he hosts with Tam Cowan on a Saturday and Sunday between 12 to 2, Stuart also hosts a podcast called Talk Media with Eamon O'Neill for the Big Light Network. Each episode, Eamon and Stuart talk with another guest from the world of media to analyse the week's news and see how it's been portrayed in the media. Do check it out, it's just brilliant, as are the other offerings from The Big Light, who are a Glasgow-based podcast network with a very fine Scots taste to their output. Tales for the East is an artist-in-residence project from Glasgow Life. I share the position with my mate Tim Marozzo, who will be taking photo portraits of the people we speak to when COVID restrictions lift. There's a couple of episodes out already featuring chats with Irene McInnes of Readvale Housing Association, Mitch Miller, an artist from Denniston, and Elaine Mackenzie Ellis, the actor of Sight Hill. There are so many more tales to be told, so if you know someone like Stuart, Elaine, Mitch or Irene who knows the tales of Denniston, Sight Hill or Hag Hill, and you think they'd be willing to talk to us for the podcast, we'd love to speak to them. Thank you to all of the people in the community who are reaching out with ideas, and especially a big thanks to floristers on Duke Street for their time and perspectives on all of this. Really, really appreciate it. Thank you. There's lots of other artist-in-residence work coming out from Glasgow Life at the moment, so do check in with it and have a look at some of the other projects if you'd like. I'd particularly recommend checking out the project called Life from Today Museum in Parkhead, where you can hear more stories from the people of the East End. If you want to drop us a line, you can reach us on info@tales-fay-the-east.com. We're also on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram, although I'm not particularly good at updating the Instagram feed. I really must get back to that. Our website, tales-fay-the-east.com, gives you some more info about the project and an intro to both Tim and I, and provides links to subjects covered in the episodes. With this residency, we're going to be offering photography and podcasting workshops, so please do feel free to drop us a line to say if you'd like to join us. We'll advertise these more as we go along so you know where to go online. The likelihood is that we'll be doing them on Zoom for the foreseeable future. As you can hear at the end of this episode, one of the subjects we're particularly keen to investigate is the role of Gaelic in the community. If you're a Gaelic speaker in the area and would like to talk to us, we'd love to have a natter. Or if you know of any interesting Gaelic-related stories or facts about the area, we'd also love to hear about them. Fiction Gírach Gaasta. Nachy. We've got lots more conversations to share with you. I can't wait to get them out to you. Thank you so much for listening. I look forward to seeing you again soon. Bóirín tang. Himi riachtaif. See you again soon. Tatibai.